From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, President Trump called it a very sad milestone, the news that 100,000 people have now died from COVID-19. Trump saying he extends his heartfelt sympathy to all the families and friends of those who've passed.
And that toll now exceeds the deaths from the Vietnam and Korean wars combined, American deaths from those wars. NPR science correspondent Rob Stein joins us now. Rob, what is the significance of 100,000 deaths from the coronavirus? Can you put that number in any kind of context?
Yeah, Jeremy, you know, it's a really stunning number and drives home what a terrible impact the pandemic is having on this country. You know, it may feel like this has been going on forever, but it's only really been a few months. And already the virus has killed about triple the number of Americans who died all year from the flu last year, and more than double the number who died from breast cancer every year, and probably as many as die from opioid overdoses and suicides combined in a whole year. So it's just a devastating loss of life, especially when you think about the fact that behind each of those deaths are families who are grieving.
Well, and that number is with all of the stay-at-home and social distancing measures that have been going on. Do we have any idea how accurate that count is?
You know, it's almost certainly an undercount, unfortunately, of the true toll for several reasons. Because of the testing shortage, a lot of the people who died from COVID-19 were never officially diagnosed, and so were not counted. And there's been some confusion, especially in the beginning, about exactly who should be counted. Many people probably died at home. So there's little doubt that far more than 100,000 people in America have died from COVID. And also, let's not forget, these are just the deaths. There have been at least 1.7 million cases of COVID in the U.S. So in addition to all those who died, many others got really sick, spent weeks in intensive care on respirators, and many are still struggling to recover from those often are terrible, debilitating complications.
And how does the number of deaths in the U.S. at this point compare to other countries?
The U.S. has only about 4% of the world's population, but the country has had about a third of all the deaths from COVID. So, you know, just for comparison, let's look at like the U.K., which is number two. The U.K. has recorded about 37,000 deaths. Italy, which we heard a lot about for a while, has had about 33,000 deaths. China, where the pandemic began, has recorded less than 5,000 deaths. So you can see, unfortunately, the U.S. is clearly the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic globally.
And do we have a sense, Rob, of whether we have passed the peak here in the U.S. or is it still getting worse?
You know, things certainly have improved in this country. Overall, the total number of cases and deaths have been falling. And as a result, the country is starting to reopen. So there is hope. But at the same time, there's still a lot of concern. There are parts of the country where things haven't really gotten better, may still be getting worse. And remember, the virus is still out there, and most people probably have never been exposed to it, so could easily get infected. So many public health experts say, look, this is far from over. In fact, it could still just be the beginning, unfortunately, especially if people let down their guard and stop doing things like wearing masks and socially distancing. The virus could start spreading like wildfire and come roaring back in places where it looks like it's under control or hit places that seemed like they had been spared. So there's a lot of concern that many, many more thousands of deaths still could be lost if we don't ease things up slowly and carefully.
That is NPR science correspondent Rob Stein. Rob, thank you.
You bet, Jeremy.
Let's get the latest now from Minneapolis, where the FBI announced today it will launch a robust investigation into the police officers involved in the death of George Floyd, the handcuffed black man who died after one officer pinned his neck to the ground with his knee. Thousands of protesters, white and black, took to the streets of Minneapolis last night, some setting fires and looting stores. Police fired tear gas and rubber bullets. At a press conference on Wednesday, the city's mayor asked why George Floyd's killer wasn't in jail. On CNN this morning, Floyd's brother Philonis made an emotional plea.
I'm tired of seeing black men die. Black lives matter, too.
NPR's Adrian Florido is in Minneapolis. Adrian, there are reports of a fatal shooting last night near the protest site, reports of an apartment building and businesses on fire. Are those fires still burning? What are you seeing?
Hi, Robin. It seems that most, if not all, of the fires have been put out by now, though a lot of the rubble is still smoldering, of course. And we're still getting a sense of just how much damage there was. Local officials are working to tally it up, but there was pretty significant damage last night, and not just in the area around where this incident happened, but really all across the city. One man was shot and killed, allegedly by a store owner who thought that he was trying to loot the store. So clearly, you know, Robin, tensions are very, very high here as protesters yeah. take out their anger and frustration over George Floyd's death and continue to call for the officers involved in his arrest to be arrested and charged themselves.
Yeah, where are we on that? Because those four officers were fired. Now the mayor pressuring the district attorney to charge them with murder. Where are we on that demand for arrests?
So none of the officers, none of the officers have been arrested or charged. There are multiple investigations going on at the same time. As you mentioned, the FBI and the Justice Department have announced federal investigations into the officers' conduct in this incident to determine whether they violated federal law. The Hennepin County District Attorney is also conducting an investigation but has not yet filed charges despite the growing outcry. Prominent civil rights leaders, the Reverend Zell Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, are headed to the city as we speak to continue to increase pressure on officials to file charges against these officers.
Now, meanwhile, these protests come in the middle of a pandemic, as we've been hearing. Many protesters we saw wearing masks before there was tear gas. What concerns are you hearing about that, the ongoing pandemic?
You know, I've asked some people about that. I went out last night to the site where George Floyd was arrested and where this officer pinned him to the ground. And I've asked people about that, and they said, look, you know, we are concerned somewhat about the pandemic. We know that this virus is dangerous, and we're trying to be mindful of that, maintain our distance, wear masks when possible, because this virus is dangerous. But look, they're saying the police are killing us too, and that's dangerous too, and we have to be out here. We have no choice. Whether in a pandemic or not, we've got to be out here raising our voice to try to seek justice for George Floyd and for all black men who've been killed by police.
NPR's Adrian Florido in Minneapolis. Adrian, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, today, Chinese lawmakers endorsed a controversial Hong Kong security law that is the focus of civilian protests and anger from the White House. Activists in Hong Kong say the new law undermines its semi-autonomy from China. Beijing says the law is needed to stem subversive activity. But yesterday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that as a result of this legislation, Washington will no longer treat Hong Kong differently than it treats Beijing. Joining us now is NPR's Emily Feng in Beijing. Emily, first of all, is China taking Pompeo's threat seriously?
There has been no official reaction from China yet. But when the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act was passed last year, they were quite critical, and they criticized the U.S. for utilizing the unrest in Hong Kong to contain China.
Why is China taking this step with this new law right now?
The first reason is because there have been almost a year of ongoing protests in Hong Kong, and Beijing has just lost patience and seen this law as a tool for extending its control over the region. And the other is Beijing feels confident enough that it can impose this law unilaterally without support from Hong Kongers.
And what about Hong Kongers? How is the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong reacting to this? And are there plans for more and bigger protests?
They had protests over the weekend. They were the biggest since the novel coronavirus hit Hong Kong, as it has to much of the world. But the protests were not that big. And part of the reason was because of short notice. There were only a few days of heads up given to protesters. But the other is a lot of people have felt fatigued. They've lost hope that protests have any effect whatsoever. There are bigger protests planned for June and July. We'll see if more protesters show up for those.
I was speaking with a friend who's been doing business in Hong Kong, an American who's been doing business in Hong Kong, who brought up the idea that a lot of big global companies that are based in Hong Kong may decide, hey, let's just go to Singapore if Hong Kong is treated exactly like mainland China. Does this whole thing threaten Hong Kong's status as a global place to do business?
It definitely does. It makes doing financial transactions more difficult because there will be extra scrutiny on those transactions, on trade, if the special trade status with the U.S. is revoked from Hong Kong. At the same time, I've heard from multinationals and law firms that they might plan to stay in Hong Kong, even if Beijing starts calling the shots in Hong Kong, simply because they would prefer some order, even if it's on Beijing's terms, in comparison to the unrest they've seen because of protests over the last year.
What happens next as this unfolds?
So Beijing's legislature today approved a motion allowing a smaller group of lawmakers to actually draft the bill. The national security law could be approved as early as June. We'll see if the U.S. decides to actually pull its special trade status with Hong Kong. But as to whether pulling Hong Kong's special trade status with the U.S. is actually going to change Beijing's mind about what it does to Hong Kong, I would wager no. Beijing is betting on the fact that its own cities will become global financial capitals with generous state subsidies, and they'll eclipse Hong Kong one day.
And it's NPR's Emily Feng joining us from Beijing. Emily, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
New York's public theater is known for cutting-edge performances and popular off-site programming, including the beloved Shakespeare in the Park. And of course, the shows it sends to Broadway, from the 1967 premiere of Hair to Hamilton. Well, next Monday, the Public Theater will hold an online gala performance, a star-studded We Are One Public. It'll be free, a virtual one-night extravaganza showcasing music, drama, storytelling artists like Antonio Banderas, Glenn Close, Elvis Costello, Audra McDonald, Sting, Philippa Sue, Anne Hathaway, and more. It's also a benefit for the theater, which, like all New York City theaters, has been dark since March 12th. Jesse Tyler Ferguson is hosting. He, of course, the red-haired Mitchell Pritchett on TV's Modern Family. Here he flaunts the cast in a promo clip from Monday's show.
Is Gordon Matthew Thomas Sumner around? So, yeah, yes. Sting. I'm talking to Audra McDonald. Hello, Miss Hathaway. Sorry, Anne. Don't know why I sounded so formal. Sorry we keep playing phone tag. I just wanted to circle back about the idea of matching rompers for the We Are One Public event.
Jesse is also supposed to be the co-star of the new Broadway show Take Me Out. It would have opened in April, and he has been the object of my stalking. I've approached him many times on the street to profess my affection. Jesse, welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us, the Public Theater's artistic director, Oscar Eustace. Oscar, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Robin.
And Oscar, start with you. This has been tough. Theaters dark mean actors out of work. When we say the program is free, but also a fundraiser, how is that going to work?
Well, it's the first time we get to try this. The idea is that, very fitting with the public ethos, this extraordinary lineup of stars is going to be made available to anybody in the world who wants to watch it. You know, my basic hope is that the people who can afford it, who can afford even small amounts, will contribute to us, but everybody will get to see it for free. And that's actually a wonderful way to greet an audience.
Well, it's the public radio model as well. And Jesse, exactly. There will be about, there'll be about 3 dozen performers, none in the same location. What could go wrong? I'm thinking of the recent birthday tribute to Stephen Sondheim. Half-hour delay. Everybody's watching Meryl Streep's background and yelling at the host, unmute yourself. What are your thoughts going in?
You know, I actually watched the Sondheim birthday celebration later that evening, so I had no idea that any of that had happened. But it's the spirit of the show must go on. I mean, I have been on stage at the Delacorte Theater where I've had to leave the stage for an hour while the audience, you know, finds shelter amongst trees and awnings, and we start up again. And it's just sort of the spirit of what theater is.
Jesse, it's funny. I just getting you ready to do this interview, you seemed kind of a mess.
I was having some sound issues already. So we'll sort it out by the time June 1st comes along.
But what's behind this is so important. Talk about, Jesse, from your point of view, you've done quite well. And there are other actors that, with theater closed, nothing's coming in. Talk about what you're seeing in your community.
I'm in a position where I've just finished an 11-year run of a television show. So I'm okay for a little while. And, you know, I was in rehearsal with a group of fantastic men and Take Me Out. And some of them were very established in their careers and some of them were making their Broadway debuts. So we're all coming to that production with very different economical backgrounds and different places in our career. you know, we're checking in with each other on social media and through text messages. And, you know, Jesse Williams and Patrick Adams and I sent little care packages to all of our cast members in New York to let them know we're thinking of them on the other coast. And it's like we're trying to extend that sense of community that theater already naturally brings.
Well, and Oscar, how do you think things change going forward? The LA Times theater critic gathered together a lot of people in the industry and asked, what do you envision? And, you know, Sarah Rule, for instance, said, I want to go back to less emphasis on content, more on ritual. We may need theater soup kitchens, make soup, bread, and theater, give it out to people who need it. Less money on a couch for a set, more on the body that's going to be on the stage. Your thoughts about what the future might hold?
Well, Robin, I think it's actually the theater is in a position that's similar to that of the country as a whole. And I think when we come out of this, we will either continue to lurch in the direction of authoritarianism and inequality and xenophobia and nationalism, which I'm afraid we've been lurching in for the last few years with a lot of the world, or we'll have the other alternative, which is that this epidemic, this plague, will make us recognize how completely interdependent we are and how much we count on each other and allow us to engage in collective action that's more equitable and more loving than what we did before. And the theater has to be part of that. I think when the theater comes out of this, we're going to have to immediately prove to people that we have something for them that matters. The first thing the public's going to do when we're allowed to gather again is send out 5 mobile units to all the different boroughs so that the first invitation is not you come back into our theaters, but we're going to go to you, to your neighborhoods, and perform for you. Because we're going to be in a tough environment economically. We're going to be in a tough environment philanthropically. And if we're not able to demonstrate that we are as important as we claim we are, we're going to get left behind.
Yeah, essential workers. Jesse, your thoughts about the changes and staying with what you're going to be doing on this gala, this idea of live streaming. John Acavelli, who's a scenic designer, said we're just going to have to get used to the new reality, streaming the new normal. Others, and I'm looking at Adam Greenfield from Playwrights Horizon, said no, anything but, you know, more Zoom theater or streaming theater. The live event is what theater is. You know, your thoughts on that?
I think it's going to have to be a balance for a little while. You know, we are figuring out this new world. And I think when we come out of this, my hope for it, my silver lining is that with this time that we're spent in quarantine, we'll come out of it with ideas of artistic expression that we didn't have before. I'm just hoping and imagining that all of our greatest living playwrights are at home during this time creating, and they're going to come out of this with new ideas. And I think, you know, we've had to pivot and as actors and as artists and try and figure out how can we continue to do what we need to do without being in a room with an audience. We create arts to be in that space with an audience, and it's a communal thing. And we're having to figure out another way to do that right now. I don't think that will be forever, but I think while we're in this space, we have to find ways of sharing that art with each other because that's what's going to keep us alive.
I couldn't agree more, Jesse. I spent about 2 weeks being a Puritan and saying, you know, into the closure and saying, you know, we have to wait until we can all gather together again. And the theater is a live audience. That's what makes it. And then about 2 weeks in, I went, that's ridiculous. Just because we're in a plague, just because we're in difficult circumstances, does not relieve me of the obligation to try to fulfill the mission of the theater. Mm-hmm. Like always, we're fulfilling it under different circumstances. These circumstances are particularly extreme, but nobody gives us the right to stop trying to do what we do. We have to keep doing it.
Well, do you ever foresee a time, Oscar, when you're directing using social distancing? You know, you're lending, I mean, can you think of a play, for instance, that would lend itself to the actors standing 6 feet away from each other and not singing into each other's faces or even wearing masks?
Here's the reality. I can't imagine that right now. That doesn't mean I'm not going to be able to imagine it. You know, my gut says we're not going to experience the full joy of live theater until people are not worried about getting sick. However, that may be a long road, and we're going to keep making theater by any means necessary. Once we're not in a shelter-at-home state, I promise you, we'll be figuring out how to test the boundaries and make theater that takes advantage of whatever circumstances are ethically and medically and legally possible for us.
Well, meanwhile, back to the gala that you're planning. Mitchell, I mean Jesse, have you been like practicing with your mute button?
I've actually participated in a few of these experiments with digital theater, and you know, I've certainly been on a lot of Zoom calls and meetings, you know, trying to figure out these things like the Public Theater Gala. I saw a few fails happen in the early days of quarantine, people taking their computers into the restroom not realizing they were on the phone still, and you know, you won't see any of those mistakes from me.
I just worry that we'll see your eye, you know, just your ear or your eye saying, can you see me?
I don't know
me?
Why you have such – you need to have a little more faith than me. I think I'm going to be just fine on June 1st.
I think it's going to be wonderful.
And Jesse, I have total confidence in you. And, you know, I've seen Jesse triumph in very complicated circumstances, I've suggested. And the talent we have lined up from Al Pacino to Meryl Streep to Lin-Manuel, it's just an extraordinary collection of people, all of whom are there because they love the public. And I'm just so honored and flattered by that I don't believe anything will go wrong technically.
Yeah. Well, the public will be there because they love these performers and they also want to see their backgrounds. So, Jesse, I'm just saying, just, you know, an Emmy or two on a shelf or something.
I actually have no personal Emmys. I've been in shows that have won Emmys, but none for me. I actually have a poster from every single summer I did at the Delacour Theater. I think I'm going to use those as my background art from the Public Theater.
We'll wait to see how Room Raider feels about it, the Twitter account that rates the backgrounds. That's Jesse Tyler Ferguson, who's going to be co-hosting the Public Theater's gala performance, a star-studded We Are One Public free virtual one-night extravaganza. For more, you can go to hearnow.org. And the theater's artistic director, Oscar Eustace. Oscar, Jesse, we need our theater back. We need Broadway back. Thank you. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
There are 90 accredited schools around the world that train guide dogs for the blind. The coronavirus pandemic has closed many of them, including the oldest one in the U.S. It's called the Seeing Eye. It's located in Morris Township, New Jersey. Reporter John Kalish tells us how everyone, pups included, is coping.
Our story begins in the home of Kristen Lake, one of the 35 full-time Seeing Eye instructors. That's a 9-week-old Labrador retriever named Ginny, who's being raised by Lake at home. She has another house guest, thanks to the pandemic, a fully trained German Shepherd called Henry, who is one of the 200 or so guide dogs from the Seeing Eye's campus that have been living with staff members and volunteers since the school closed. Lake continues to put Henry through his paces.
It's just nice to get out there and know that he still can pull and harness, and he still stops at curbs and will listen to my commands, and just helps keep him sharp and keep me sharp as well.
It takes 4 months to train a dog at the Seeing Eye. Then the dogs work with their human partners for another 18 or 25 days of drills, depending on whether they're a first-time or replacement guide dog. Since late March, all training at the Seeing Eye's 300-plus acre campus has ceased, and puppy breeding has been scaled back.
There are really two things you can't do remotely. One is train a dog, and one is train a person with a dog.
CEO Glenn Hoagland says the Seeing Eye has been able to continue admission interviews remotely and get a functioning veterinary telehealth system up and running. The majority of the dogs that it sends out into the world each year go to replace guide dogs that are too old to continue their work.
There are people who are without a dog because they had to retire their dog or their dog passed away, and those folks are probably the highest priority, and some of them we may have to serve in their home community if we can, as soon as we're able to travel.
Nancy Stevens of Bend, Oregon, was scheduled to travel to the Seeing Eye's New Jersey campus to get a new dog this spring. She needs to replace her fourth guide dog, a yellow lab called Abby. Abby is in good health, but Stevens says she'll be careful not to push the dog too hard in the warm weather. Uncertain when the Seeing Eye will reopen, Stevens has put her plans to work with blind youths at a summer camp on hold.
I want to keep my schedule as clear as possible so that whenever Seeing Eye does open, I have the ability to attend the school when they have the opening for me.
The Seeing Eyes' Glenn Hoagland doesn't know when the school will be able to reopen, but when it does, he says one of the challenges will be to institute social distancing and modify class sizes. So far, the organization, which has no government funding and doesn't accept insurance, hasn't furloughed or laid off staff.
In 91 years, we've never not served a class. When you think about the history of this organization, which was founded in 1929, the year of the Great Depression, we never had anything quite like this, but we will survive and we will come back strong, we believe.
Earlier this year, the Seeing Eye Dog was officially designated the State Dog of New Jersey. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
With a reminder to support, if you can, these nonprofits in these tough times.
Globally, about 13% of the world is considered obese. They have a body mass index above 30. Here in the United States, more than a third of people are obese. Is there a connection between that and the high prevalence of severe coronavirus in the U.S. compared with other countries? Well, a recent study published in the Clinical Infectious Diseases Journal finds that obesity is a risk factor in COVID-19 hospital admissions for people under 60. Joining us now by Skype is Dr. Jennifer Leiter, who's the lead author of that study. She's a pediatric infectious disease specialist and hospital epidemiologist at NYU Langone Medical Center. Dr. Leiter, tell us what your study found.
When a patient started arriving at our medical center, it was always shocking to see younger patients get intubated and admitted to the ICU with COVID-19. And it was remarkable that many of them were overweight. So we decided just to look at risk according to BMI. And we found that adults under age 60 who were obese had a higher risk of getting admitted to the hospital and getting admitted to the ICU compared to people that had healthier weights and were non-obese.
So what do you think are the reasons that obesity would increase someone's risk of getting severely ill with COVID-19?
The study was really just an observational study. I can give you my personal theories. One of them is that people that are obese in general just have more compromised respiratory function at baseline compared to people that are not obese. So, for example, we know that obstructive sleep apnea is more prevalent, as is asthma or restrictive lung disease or reflux in people that are obese compared to people that are not obese. Another theory was that people that are obese may be more on just the inflammatory spectrum, even if they have not received a diagnosis of diabetes or cardiovascular disease. So, for example, you know, they may be early on in having hyperglycemia, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and these are all risk factors for a more moderate or severe course of COVID-19. And the third theory was molecular. We know that the receptor that the virus attaches to is called the ACE2 receptor, and it is located not only in the lungs, but also on fat cells as well, on adipose cells. Another reason could be that when the SARS-CoV-2, the virus, attaches to the ACE2 receptor, it enters the cell through a protein called TMPRSS2, and we know that TMPRSS2 is sensitive to androgens or male hormones. It's just a theory, but this may be why men have a more severe course and why obese people may have a more severe course, because they do have a higher likelihood of more just circulating androgens. So it may be possible that the virus has more opportunity to enter cells easier.
Now, as you know, according to the OECD, the United States has, if not the highest, then one of the highest rates of obesity in the entire world of any country. Do you think that that has contributed to the fact that we have become one of the epicenters of COVID-19?
I think that there are regional vulnerabilities depending on where someone is located. So, for example, in China, it's possible that pollution and smoking made people in that region more vulnerable. In Italy, they've certainly had a significant course. They have a a high percentage of people that are elderly, and their homes are often multi-generational. Grandparents live with grandkids. Mm-hmm. So I think they were particularly vulnerable. And I think in the United States, our Achilles heel will be obesity. We have a large percentage of the population, about 40% of the population in the United States, has a BMI over 30, which is considered obese. And I think it puts us at a substantial risk. As far as New York City being one of the epicenters, I guess, of COVID, I think that has more to do with population density than having a large portion of the population that is obese.
But you think that in general, our Achilles heel in the United States will be obesity?
Yes, I think we are vulnerable to having a larger population of a moderate to severe course due to obesity.
There is a stigma around obesity. It's a sensitive subject for many people. Does that complicate your ability to study the link between obesity and COVID-19? Or how do you talk about it with patients?
I think it's important to sometimes take the emotional implications out of it when you're just trying to identify risk factors of people that can have a more severe course of COVID. It's important to identify risk factors because those are the people we may manage differently. So, for example, what does these findings imply? It implies that obese people are at a 2 to 3 times higher risk group than people that are not obese. So they may be the people that should isolate longer until the incidence in their region of COVID is, you know, extremely low. They may be the people that once we have good therapeutics identified, that when they're infected with COVID, they should probably be treated to prevent the risk of progression to moderate or severe course. So I know it could be a sensitive topic, but it's also important just to talk frankly and plainly and identify the higher risk groups.
But it's also an area where I can imagine, you know, unlike somebody who's going through cancer treatment or somebody who's got a weakened immune system, they think to themselves, yes, I am at higher risk because of this. People who are overweight may not think of themselves as a person at higher risk of getting COVID-19 because they just don't consider that to be a risk factor.
Right. I mean, I think in general, people that are overweight are less healthy than people that have a BMI of less than 30. So I think they're at risk of progressing to several kinds of diseases, not just having a more moderate to severe course of COVID-19.
You know, I feel like if I go back pre-COVID-19, almost every time there was a story involving some kind of health issue, the message from the medical community is, you know, overall, eat healthier, exercise more, don't smoke, and that will help you in many, 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 many kinds of issues. Do you think that it's worth thinking about that again now, given the situation we're all living through?
Absolutely. In general, those three recommendations will lead to healthier lives and longer lives and higher quality in some ways.
I just want to ask you about one other thing, because you are there in New York City, which at least for the last couple of months has been really the epicenter in the United States of the COVID-19 outbreak. You are a pediatric infectious disease specialist. Have you been treating children with this mysterious Kawasaki disease-like illness that seems to have a connection to COVID-19?
Yes, I have been.
And what do you make of that, or what have you learned about that part of this story?
So we know that coronaviruses can trigger Kawasaki disease. What has been surprising is that we're seeing older children with this type of Kawasaki-like illness. We know that it seems to be an inflammatory response to the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and it's presenting a little differently in the younger kids and the older children and young adults.
Have you seen enough of it to say to parents of kids of a certain age, you know, you need to be worried about this, or does it feel still very rare?
It still feels rare. I guess as a pediatrician and in a hospital, I'm seeing quite a few cases. But, you know, we suspect that 25 to 30% of New Yorkers had COVID. And when you have this new germ on a very large population, it almost shouldn't surprise us to now get cases of Kawasaki or Kawasaki-like syndrome. So it's still a pretty rare syndrome, considering that a very large quantity of people were infected with SARS-CoV-2 in a small area.
That is Dr. Jennifer Leiter, who is a pediatric infectious disease specialist and hospital epidemiologist at NYU Langone Medical Center. Dr. Leiter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
It's hard to imagine a sport where social distancing would be any more impossible than rugby. Rugby gives us the word scrum, people puppy piling on each other so tight it's like one body. But rugby competition resumed in Australia today, despite the raging global pandemic. Let's get our check-in on sports with Here Now sports analyst Mike Pesca, also host of the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Can you imagine being at the bottom of a scrum right now? How do they play rugby safely?
Well, how do they ever play rugby safely, right? the important thing to know is that in Australia, like everywhere in the world, there are cases of COVID-19, but it is so far, far less than it is here in America and in other places. In Europe, there are 7,000 infections in the entire country and 100 deaths. Mm-hmm. And Australia is a country with a population of 25 million. So that's, you know, double a state like Florida or Illinois. But both of those states have experienced either near or over 5,000 deaths. So when we compare it, keep in mind that Australia's done a very good job, also aided by the fact that they're an island country and their summer is our winter. But they have very low cases, and they thought that it was time to start up the economy, sports being part of it. And yes, they are washing their hands beforehand and gelling and doing temperature checks. But basically, since it hasn't spread so much there, they're just going to play rugby like they always play rugby and then monitor and test and hope for the best.
Yeah, the thought of washing your hands before rugby seems so, but anyway, they're doing that. What are we doing here in the U.S.? You know, we're seeing NASCAR races, no fans, some golf, but where are we on the major professional sports leagues? The National Hockey League has a plan to resume play. How's that supposed to work?
Yes. Right. So the leagues are either in a camp of having a plan but not knowing when, or having a when but not exactly having a plan. So right now, the NHL is in the we have a plan camp, and it's an interesting plan. 24 of the 31 teams will make the playoffs. Some of the teams will get byes depending on how they've done on the season thus far. And the commissioner of the NHL, Gary Bettman, says we plan to institute this in July. They hope. They don't know exactly when they can institute it, but the teams and the owners are on board, and people are excited for this, for the return of sports and this different format. There would be bubbles. This is a big consideration for most of the leagues that are thinking of coming back, which is we just won't go to our regular arenas. We'll play in specific places, and this is a way to shoehorn some vestiges of a season in. When you contrast that to the NFL, which definitely has a when, they're saying we're going to start in September like we've always started. Although, you know, they allow maybe we could push it back a week or two. But right now we're starting. We don't know exactly when. We don't know exactly how. We don't know exactly if there will be fans. It seems unlikely. And they don't know exactly how the playoffs will go or if there'll be bye weeks. So they'd like for it to happen on their schedule. But as we know, the virus doesn't respect anyone's schedule.
Right. In Major League Baseball, we hear that players and owners are arguing over money, and that might get in the way of whatever season we might have. Your thoughts on what's going on there?
Yes. It seems that what the owners want to do is say, we will be making so much less money. Let us all share in the pain. And what the players point out is, no, we have contracts and we don't get any upside when you make a lot of money. There's so much distrust. I would say of all the professional sports, there is more animosity between that union and player group and that ownership group, especially because the owners often, well, let's just say they're misleading or a bit opaque about how valuable their franchises prices are. Mm-hmm. But there is a team, the Atlanta Braves, is publicly traded, so everyone knows what their books are. And so you have all these baseball teams always crying poverty, and you could look at Liberty Media owns the Braves. You could look at their books, and they're making hundreds of millions of dollars. So the players are saying, we don't want to take a haircut, you know, that term. Mm-hmm. But they're going to have to. And I think what right now, they're not actually arguing on, will we just not have baseball? They're arguing on, how much less money will we take than what we bargained for? And the players, in a way, are in the driver's seat. You can't play without them. But in another way, if they just say, well, our $100 million, you know, in some cases, our $50 million salary has to be honored and we won't take $30 million, man, would they lose public support. They know this. Yeah. I think in terms of the contract, they could get it done. In terms of safe play, that does remain to be seen, but they're hoping for a July 4th return.
Okay, briefly, I want to try this. Tennis. Dr. Deborah Birx made an unintentionally hilarious attempt to explain how tennis could be played without people touching the other person's tennis balls. It went viral. People can Google it, but basically players would use marked balls so they would only touch their own tennis balls. Your thoughts, yes. Will we be seeing major tournaments?
I don't see why not. This is a good distanced sport. And if one were only to serve and volley with one's spheroid objects, here I am not falling into that trap, it could certainly be done. And also, you know, a lot of evidence shows that the virus does stay on surfaces, but that's not a vector for transmission.
Yeah.
You know, if you do play tennis or even golf and touch a hole, you know, there's been no documented cases of anyone getting it that way. It's important to be as safe as possible. And if you can mark your orbs, then you can be safe.
We're done.
But it's a sport that can be done, I think.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We're going to get out of here. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.